From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Welcome to episode number 148 and the final part of my chat with extraordinary woman Sarah Hung. If you are new to the podcast and this is your first episode, go back a couple to episodes number 146 and 147 to hear Sarah's story and the first half of the breastfeeding information. Sarah has been on a low-carb and ketogenic diet for nearly 4 years and has never been happier with her diet and health. She was first accredited as an international board-certified lactation consultant in 2001. She ran a private practice called Lotus Lactation in Hong Kong for several years and previously worked on the maternity ward of the Matilda International Hospital in Hong Kong. Once upon a time, she was a mathematician and a transport planner. Sarah trained in the community with La Leche League and was accredited as a leader in July 1995. She has been helping mothers with breastfeeding problems and leading LLL meetings in Hong Kong ever since. Sarah has 4 children, all of whom were breastfed. Here we are at the final part of my chat with Sarah. I hope you have been enjoying it so far. Please remember that this is a generalized conversation and is not medical advice. If you're having any problems with breastfeeding or are concerned that something is wrong, please get some help from a professional. If you are breastfeeding right now or are expecting too soon, congratulations. I hope you and your baby are doing well and enjoying this lovely time together. And so you mentioned about the importance of the nutrition for the mother. Is this a period of time when the mother needs to be eating more than she normally does? Should she be adding, I don't know, if there's a sort of a certain amount of extra food that she should be consuming during this time?
Well, I would say the first 6 to 8 weeks after the birth, you shouldn't even be thinking about trying to lose weight. You should just be thinking about surviving with this brand new baby that you're looking after and trying to, you know, feel as good as you can and not worry about your weight. Just live life, basically. If you then want to try and lose weight afterwards, I would definitely take it slowly. From a low carb point of view, there are actually concerns about being on a low carb or a keto diet whilst you're pregnant and whilst you're breastfeeding. And although it's very rare, there is the possibility of serious complications. One of the things that we know is that when you're pregnant and when you're lactating, you're naturally more ketogenic than when you're not. So a lactating woman who fasts for 12 to 14 hours tends to be in the same ketosis as a non-lactating woman who fasts for 18 to 24 hours. And consequently, the ketones can go much higher than if you're not lactating. So we want to make certain that your ketones don't go too high, because that can lead to serious complications. So the general suggestion is that rather than being under 20 carbs a day, that you're under 50 carbs a day. And in actual fact, what people tend to find is that even though they're eating more carbs, their ketosis is similar to what they were before pregnancy and before lactating on 20 carbs a day.
Oh, that's interesting.
When you start the keto diet and the possibility of going through the keto flu, there are things that you need to look out for. The first one is dehydration, because obviously dehydration will have an impact on your milk supply. Mm. If you do get dehydrated and then you rehydrate, the milk supply should just bounce back again. But whilst you're dehydrated, it could have an impact. There is also, if you suddenly go and reduce your number of calories, that also can have an impact on your milk supply, because your body's used to eating a certain number of calories. And if you suddenly say, oh, we're only going to eat half that number, your body thinks you've gone into starvation. And obviously it will protect you over protecting the baby. And then the third thing about the ketogenic diet, which is one of the benefits if you are not pregnant or lactating, is the fact that it makes you feel less hungry. Mm. So you naturally don't tend to eat between meals, and you naturally have smaller meals. So it's easy to lose weight. But there is therefore more possibility that you're not eating enough and you're not eating often enough for you to be keeping your milk supply up easily.
So it sounds like then it's something that you just need to be a bit more aware of if you're eating ketogenically. Is there a need to, whatever your diet is there a need to actively increase the amount you're eating, regardless of whether you're thinking about losing weight? But do you need more food to be providing this milk than you would normally be having? So is it necessary to actually up your intake for this period of time that you're breastfeeding?
Yes. They estimate that whilst you're pregnant, you need another 250 to 350 calories a day. And whilst you're lactating, you need an extra 500.
All right, so that's a fair bit, yeah.
All the research is done about calories. Mm. So it's really difficult when you're talking low carb and wanting to talk about carbs instead of calories, because all the guidelines are talking about calories. But it says that as a breastfeeding mother, you should not go below 1,800 calories a day. And, you know, people, the majority of people that I know of are going ketogenic to lose weight. But there are a number of very significant other reasons for going ketogenic. Mm. And so what I would say is, if you're doing it just to lose weight, then you can play about. You know, you might not go completely into ketosis because you're eating a few too many carbs, but you're likely to still be losing weight. But if you're doing it for other reasons and you really truly want to be in ketosis, then I would consider measuring your ketones so that you know whether they're going up and up and up, and whether you should start eating more carbs to stop them going too high.
Hmm. It sounds like a great period of time when you're having the conversation about keto and weight loss, and it's the kind of foods that you often suggest to people that they certainly cut down on and maybe remove from their diet for a while, all those things like, you know, the keto treats and the nuts and the cheese and things like that. It sounds like, from a number of perspectives, a really good time to be adding those things. You were saying it's quite often, it's not necessarily going to be easy just to increase the amount of food you eat, because as you were saying, you know, keto often really, it really does impact your appetite, and it's not going to be so easy to just eat another 500 calories a day's worth of food. But it's probably going to be a bit easier if that comes in the form of some cheese and nuts and a slab of cheesecake or something. Do you know what I mean? It sounds like a good reason to have these slightly more sort of indulgent foods for all sorts of reasons, for, you know, for it being a treat and to make you feel good, but also to, you know, to get those extra calories in that you need to produce your milk.
Well, it sounds good to me. One of the things I would say is that complications from your ketones going too high is actually very, very rare. There is very little medical literature about it. Generally, it's because of not just the lactation, but an extra problem with the lactation. For instance, somebody who's having bariatric surgery and is breastfeeding, or somebody who's ill and is not able to keep any food down. So basically they're fasting, even if they are trying to eat food. And because they're not taking any nutrition at all, then their ketones are going too high. So generally it's not just lactating and the keto diet. It's lactating, the keto diet, and another risk factor which causes the problem. But having said that, when the medical establishment knows there is a problem, or a potential problem, they try and avoid it. And so they will tell you, don't do it. Whereas I would say, do it with your eyes open if you're going to do it. So you know what to look for and what the problems are. So that as soon as you think, oh, my ketones are going too high, you go and eat something to bring them down. And what I would definitely say is no fasting. No fasting whilst you're pregnant and no fasting whilst you're lactating. Because you get into ketosis so much easier, you will then so much more easily get into dangerous levels of ketosis. And I don't have any evidence for my next comment, but everybody knows that when you're breastfeeding, supposedly it's easier to lose weight. And I think part of the reason why it's easier to lose weight is because it's easier to get into ketosis. It does sort of depend. You know, if you need 500 extra calories when you're breastfeeding and you say, right, I'm going to eat apples for that 500 calories, that's like 10 extra apples. It's difficult to eat 10 extra apples every day. So you're likely to fall off and maybe only have one or two extra. And so consequently, you're likely to lose weight. If you say, I'm going to have a slice of chocolate cake.
Not easier.
Well, a slice of chocolate cake might actually be 750 calories. And so you think, after you've finished one, you think, oh, I'll just have a second one. And then you've had 1,500 extra calories. And that way it's much easier to put on weight. So it does depend what you are eating for those extra calories. And obviously we would say nutritious, dense food would be better for you.
We've all heard, if we're keto, we've all heard that argument, oh, you shouldn't be keto because haven't you heard about ketoacidosis? And apparently this is something that is thrown at women who are breastfeeding, who are keto, as this is a possible danger. You have just, you've kind of been talking about that already, but there is also a specific type of acidosis that is associated with it, right? Lactic acidosis. Perhaps you could, you kind of have already addressed that, but maybe there's something you want to add about that.
Well, there's basically three different types of ketoacidosis. There's diabetic ketoacidosis, where your body doesn't have enough insulin in it. And so if you get that, you have to go to hospital and they give you insulin Then there is alcoholic ketoacidosis, where again, if you get that, and it's tied with alcohol consumption and a lot of alcohol consumption, they take you to hospital and sort you out. And then the third one is starvation ketoacidosis, which is basically when fasting has gone wrong. And it is generally thought that when you fast, your ketones will increase and then they will level off and plateau and they won't keep going up and up and up. But in occasional individuals, it seems that doesn't happen and they do keep going up and up and up and up. And your ketones are acidic, which causes your blood to be acidic, which is why it's called ketoacidosis. So if your blood becomes too acidic, then you get all sorts of problems such as nausea, vomiting, abdominal pains and diarrhea are the main four symptoms. And obviously you're so ill you have to go to hospital. So this is starvation ketoacidosis. And what lactation ketoacidosis is a subset of starvation ketoacidosis in women who are breastfeeding. And the reason why more women who are breastfeeding get this than the general population of women who are doing the keto diet, and particularly who are fasting, is because their bodies are more easy to go into ketosis and to go to higher levels of ketosis than a woman who is not breastfeeding. And so it is very rare. If you look through the medical literature, as I have done in the last 2 months, you find about 10 cases that are documented. So it is not a common problem, but it is a potential problem, and therefore it is something you need to be aware of. And it seems to me it's much more a problem with fasting than it is with keto. Mm. But, you know, there is one case that I read about a woman who didn't feel like eating, so she didn't.
Mm.
And then she got into problems. So I think it's important that you are aware that if you don't feel like eating, maybe you need to eat anyway.
Mm.
Because like in non-lactating women, we say, if you're not, you know, eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full. But when you're breastfeeding, it's not just your body you're looking after. It's the baby's too. And so sometimes you might have to eat when you're not interested.
Mm.
Just because you know you've got to keep going for the baby.
Yes, that makes sense. And I think your comment that you made earlier about it's fine to be keto, just do it with your eyes open. Do it with this added knowledge that you just have to be a little bit more mindful, a little bit more aware of what's going on with your body and what that means. For example, if you start maybe feeling a bit sick, or if you, like you said, you don't feel like eating for a long period of time, you just need to be a little bit more aware and potentially to be keeping an eye on what your ketones are doing by measuring as well. And then as long as you're aware, there's not going to be a problem, because you're going to be on top of it as soon as it looks like you might be in the realms of approaching a problem.
Yeah, I would agree with that good summing up.
And I think certainly from an outsider's perspective, this is one of the things I see discussed most when it comes to breastfeeding. And that is, how important is it? How much impact does what you eat and drink is the big one. And I think you know what I'm going to say, alcohol. How much does what you input affect the output of what comes out in your breast milk?
Generally, your breast milk quantity and quality stay constant. So if for some reason the mother does not have sufficient nutrients for both herself and the milk, the nutrients will go into the milk and will deplete the mother's body. And so consequently, if you find that there is, you know, if you find that the baby is deficient in something, the solution is not to supplement the baby. the solution is to supplement the mother, because you kill two birds with one stone that way.
Mm.
What we know is that you don't have to just be malnourished, but you have to be severely malnourished before either the quantity or the quality of your breast milk changes. So in the world, you know, in the Western world, in the first world, it's highly unlikely that you will come across these situations. There is an indication that the types of fat you eat has a knock-on effect of the type of fats in your milk. If you're on a low-fat, high-carb diet, the amount of fat in your milk tends to be lower than if you're on a high-fat, low-carb diet. The amount of fat in your milk tends to be higher. And consequently, the volume might be a little bit less in order to keep the same number of calories. So when people are worrying about their milk supply, you've also got to think about how calorie dense is your milk as well, you know.
So somebody asked about the carb count in the milk being impacted by the carb count of what you eat. So it sounds like the way that's impacted depends on how high fat your diet is. So the thing that gets impacted most in the milk is the amount of fat.
Yes, that's my understanding, is that the thing that changes is the amount of fat. And so like omega-3 and omega-6 fats. If you have a diet that's high in omega-3, your milk will be higher in omega-3 and vice versa.
Logically speaking, that is just something that's come into my mind when people have mentioned that if they maybe transition from a standard American diet, so a higher carb, lower fat diet, to a keto diet, and they notice that their milk supply goes down a bit, that maybe actually there's not a problem in that. It's the composition of the milk that's changed, and it's actually turned into a more fat dense milk. So your body doesn't need to be producing quite as much. Would that maybe make sense?
Well, it makes sense to me, but I don't have any studies that I can quote for you at the moment.
Right. Yes, it's seems to be logical, but can't prove it. So what about, and this is something I think where people, I've certainly seen some judgmental type comments, what about alcohol? What about the woman who sits down to relax of an evening and wants to have a glass of wine? Is that going to have a negative impact on her breast milk? Or is the body just very good at, like you were saying before, about keeping the breast milk pretty consistent despite what you're putting into it? Now, I'm not talking about having two bottles of wine here, but, you know, the odd glass or two of wine, how much impact, or, you know, whatever your drink of choice is, how much impact is that going to have on the breast milk?
Well, the thing about alcohol is that it does go into the milk. And it goes into the milk quite readily, and it comes out of the milk quite readily too. But the amount of alcohol in the milk is relative to the amount of alcohol in the blood. So if you're like over the legal limit to drive, you're going to have more alcohol in your milk than if you're under the legal limit to drive. And the more alcohol you drink, so you, like if you binge drink, then you're going to have a lot of alcohol in your milk. But if we're just talking about like the odd glass of wine here or there, particularly if you have it with food, it's not really going to impact that much. It's not like being pregnant and drinking, because when you're pregnant, your blood supply goes through the placenta into the baby.
Right.
But when you're breastfeeding, the alcohol goes into your blood supply, and then it has to cross what we call the blood-breast barrier and get into the milk. And that's not actually an easy thing to do.
Right.
And so you don't get the full force of what is in the blood. You only get a percentage of it. One study I read, which I thought was quite interesting, was that when you drink alcohol for the next 4 hours, it has an effect of reducing your milk supply a bit. But then in the following 12 hours, it increases the milk supply. Hmm. So that after 16 hours, you've got exactly the same milk supply as you had before you took the drink. So if you want to have a drink with your dinner, I don't see that it's a problem. The baby might say, I've got to nurse more often because it's gone down a bit, but then it will increase again and he'll nurse less often. The problem I see is that if you're not having just one drink, but you're having lots of drinks and you're doing it all day and every day, and then I would be concerned to watch the baby and is the baby coping?
Yes, that makes sense. And yes, it's very interesting what you were saying about the difference between alcohol during pregnancy and alcohol in breastfeeding. And I think it's just something, you know, I don't think we should be judgmental about what somebody else is doing anyway, but it often seems to happen and it seems to be that the guilty person on your shoulder saying, oh, you really shouldn't be having that. But it seems much more accepted now that actually that if the mum wants to enjoy a glass or two of wine, especially like you say with her meal, that probably overall on balance it's going to be a good thing. If it's something that's going to be relaxing her and she finds enjoyable, it's not going to have a negative impact on the baby overall. It sounds like that's something that's perfectly fine to do if she wants to.
I think it does depend on the quantity, you know. Mm-hmm. But there are resources online which will tell you how long it will be before all the alcohol is out of your system.
Right.
So, yeah, I had one mother who, it was her 40th birthday, and she wanted to enjoy the party. And so we looked it up and found out how many hours it was going to be before all the alcohol she was going to consume would be out of her body. And she pumped some milk to leave for the babysitter prior to that, and then just waited until the time before she resumed breastfeeding. So I think there are ways around whatever problem you've got. If you have somebody who's like an alcoholic and is constantly drinking alcohol, then I think that could be a problem.
Yes.
But being drunk and looking after a baby is more of a problem, in my eyes, than having a bit of alcohol in your milk.
Mm. What happens, and I can't quite see why this would happen, seeing as your body makes the milk specifically for your baby, but what happens when your baby can't tolerate your milk?
Is it possible?
Well, I thought it was. I thought that this does happen sometimes.
There's something called lactose intolerance, but often this is a misdiagnosis.
Ah.
And it is not that the baby is intolerant to the mother's milk. If you have a very forceful milk ejection reflex, when you breastfeed, you make the milks in the areolae, which are the milk-making glands. And what happens is that round the milk-making gland, you have a muscle. And when you have the milk ejection reflex, that muscle squeezes and pushes the milk out. So it pushes it from the milk-making gland down the ducts and out of the nipple. And the hormone that causes that muscle to squeeze is oxytocin. So there are cases where the milk comes out too fast for the baby to be able to cope with. And then the baby can get green foamy stools and things. And often that's called lactose intolerance. But it isn't really an intolerance to lactose. What it is having too much lactose in the milk because it's coming out too quickly. And so what we need to do is slow that down, and there are various different things that you can do. The first thing we tend to do is ask you to be in this laid back position back to when you first had the baby, because then the milk's pushing up towards gravity instead of if the baby's underneath you, the milk's pouring into the baby's mouth.
Makes sense.
And the other advantage is that if the baby does get too much milk in its mouth and can't cope, if it's underneath your breast, there's nothing the baby can do other than struggle and splutter. Whereas if it's on top of you, all it has to do is open its mouth and you get wet, but the baby doesn't choke. There's other things that we call block feeding, where you just feed on one side for a certain length of time, which allows the other side to fill up with fill, which will tell your body to stop making so much. So there are tricks that we can try to get over this. And it, obviously, each case depends on the individual circumstances.
That's very interesting and makes more sense. I couldn't quite get my head around why a baby would be intolerant to the milk. So yeah, that makes a lot more sense to me. There were some people talking about mixing formula feeding with breast milk. I mean, I would sense from everything that you've said that that's not ever something that you would recommend, unless maybe that there is a problem with supply that you can't get over. And so you do need to supplement the amount of milk with something external. But it sounds like if you've got everything working as optimally as it should be able to work, that there would never be any need for it. So would it potentially come down to a desire to mix and match? What would your feelings be on that?
Well, ideally, the baby will have its own mother's milk. In situations where the mother can't supply enough milk for the baby, the second choice is donor milk. After that, we come down to the use of formula. And this is just from a health point of view. But a lot of the decisions mothers make are not based on that. They're based on the fact that I've got to go out to work, I've got to earn money. You know, she has other demands on her time, not just this baby, but other children and other things. So in today's society, a lot of it boils down to what is convenient for the mother. But one thing I would like to highlight is the fact that any breastfeeding that the baby gets is good for the baby. So, you know, if you feel that you don't have enough milk and you need to supplement, it doesn't mean you have to give up breastfeeding. You know, even if the baby's only getting one or two feeds a day, that is still a worthwhile thing.
And so presumably that also is the same to be said for the other things you were saying. You know, problems with the time, problems with having to go back to work. I know, particularly in the States, pregnancy leave is pretty short, isn't it? So that's a very real problem.
The biggest problem in the States is the fact that it's not paid. And so if you can't afford it, it's even shorter.
Yeah.
But we live in the world. We don't live in an ideal world. And so we just make the decisions that seem best to us at the time. And maybe if we were in a different position, we would make different decisions. But it's the mother's and the family's decision. It's nobody else's decision. And only they know the exact circumstances that they're in and whether full breastfeeding is for them or not. When I say that any breastfeeding is better than none, it's just that often people see it as a choice between, oh, I breastfeed or a bottle feed. And they don't seem to see that you can marry the two a bit. You know, you can do some breastfeeding and you can do some bottle feeding. And that's still a good option.
And presumably the same would be said for when you decide to stop breastfeeding. When you decide to do that.
What's your question?
What is my question? Presumably there's no set time that you stop breastfeeding, that you transition from breastfeeding to weaning, say, or perhaps you transitioned from breastfeeding to more formula feeding. Presumably, again, that just comes down to circumstances, to context. In an ideal world, is there an optimal time to make that change?
The World Health Organization recommends that you exclusively breastfeed for the first 6 months of the baby's life. That means that the baby has nothing other than breast milk for the first 6 months. And then you slowly introduce what we call complementary foods, which basically means starting solids, whilst continuing breastfeeding for up to 2 years and beyond. And there are quite a lot of cultures where this 2 years features, like it's there in Muslim culture, mm-hmm. because Muhammad said you should breastfeed for 2 years. And if you look into other cultures too, it's there. It's quite interesting when you go back and look at information about humans, because we're so used as humans to giving our babies, when they're about 6 months old, to giving them what we call baby foods and to feeding them. But amongst the whole of the animal kingdom, we are the only species that do this. Hmm. No other species gives their children at weaning age weaning foods like we do. So, you know, if you take a gorilla, for instance, the mother gorilla just puts food down in front of the babies and the babies either eat it or they don't eat it, but it's exactly the same food as the mother's eating. Whereas when we start our children on solids, we give them special weaning foods. And there is a lot of thought that this has given us the evolutionary advantage that we now have, in that we are dominant in the world, because it allowed other people other than the mother to look after the baby, and it allowed us to feed other foods to the baby that they couldn't have managed. They couldn't have managed at 6 months. They might have to have waited until they were 2 years to feed. And so it allowed them to grow quickly and become more viable at a younger age, which meant that the mother could have more children. And so it allowed humans to reproduce more quickly, basically, which is why a gorilla takes like 5 years to 6 years to reproduce, but we can do it in two. But this leads on to the question of what foods should you give to a baby when it's starting solids? Mm. And the overwhelming, if you ask mothers, the overwhelming choice seems to be rice cereal. But rice cereal is not nutritious. It is much better to give your children nutrient-dense foods. And one of the first foods that is recommended is meat, because it is so nutrient-dense. And also it contains a lot of iron, which the baby tends to need around about 6-7 months too.
Mm, interesting. Well, I'm sure we could do another podcast entirely on weaning. And so we won't go down that track, because we're already into marathon recording time. So I'm very conscious of letting you go to sleep. So unless there's anything else that we haven't discussed that you particularly wanted to get across, you're the breastfeeding expert, so if there's anything that I haven't brought up or that you wanted to get across, now's the time. Otherwise, we'll go into the typical way we end the show, with a top tip.
A top tip. For me, and I don't know if it would work for everybody else, but I tell people I don't eat sugar. So if they want to, if they're offering me a piece of cake or fruit or something, I'll just say, I'm sorry, I don't eat sugar. And I have a friend who's an alcoholic, and if he gets offered alcohol, he just says, sorry, I don't drink alcohol. Mm. And that's the end, you know. And once you've told somebody, I don't eat sugar, you can't then say, actually, I will just have a piece of that after all, because the loss of face of going back on what you've just said is too much. That works for me. I read stories and read other people's posts and the KKB and things about them being pressurized, but I've never been pressurized, and I'm not certain why, but maybe I just give off a vibe that don't pressurize me.
You have that look. You give them the look. I mean, I like that. It's very specific, like you say, and I think it's sensible to liken it to alcohol. I don't drink alcohol. I don't eat sugar. It's very specific. It's very easy for somebody to understand. It's actually often a lot easier than trying to get into the whole carb thing. Oh, I don't eat carbs. Because then you get into well, what is a carb? And, oh, is this a carb? Is that a carb? And people will often, you know, think because they have a certain image of what you don't eat. And then, as I said, they might associate it with being gluten-free, for example. So they'll go to great effort or expense to provide things for you that actually end up being really high carb, but they're gluten-free. So, you know, they might have a load of rice flour in or something like that. But I don't eat sugar is specific enough that leaves no misunderstanding. I think it's a great tip.
I'm glad you like it.
It's not to say that you won't get arguments from some people, but, you know, perhaps it helps if you combine it with a stern look at the same time.
My Chinese family is very, very supportive of whatever I want to do, basically. You know, there's a lot of talk when I had children, because breastfeeding was so uncommon, about what my mother-in-law thought. But my mother-in-law fed all six of her babies, and her view was, I did it, so it's good enough for you too. But I tell them that I don't eat sugar, and they don't ask me, you know, and they don't get offended if I say, no, I'm sorry, I don't want that. You know, they just give it to somebody else. There's enough of us that the cakes are going to get eaten anyway.
Yes, that's very true. Well, fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing so much of your time and your experience and knowledge. I'm sure there are many people out there who are going to find it every bit as interesting as I did, and hopefully useful too. So thank you very much, Sarah. It's been a very great pleasure.
And mine too. Thank you.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman Podcast Instagram and Facebook pages, and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's own quote is from Unknown. Breastfeeding is nature's health plan. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.